Couldn't remember the greatest senator in the world. No, this is a tribute
to the greatest senator in the world. All right.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode XXVI of the Co-Conspirators podcast. I'm your host, Caecilius Luke, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Senator Callum.
Hello there.
And Tribune John.
Hi, everyone.
I'm assuming Senator's better than Tribune.
Yeah, it definitely is, but Tribune's no mean rank. But yeah, Senator's the top of the top, really, isn't it?
I like it.
If you haven't already guessed, in today's episode, we're transporting back in time once again to visit one of the greatest empires of all time, the Roman Empire. Before we start, I'd just like to mention we have finally decided to make a website. It's in its baby stages right now, and we will look to continually improve it, but you can find a link to that in the description below. Moving on. We owe the Romans a lot. They were pioneers in a number of important trades, from sanitation to plumbing to taxation and feasting to accounting, John. So you've got a lot to owe the Romans there.
Bane of my life.
How dare they decide to take ledgers of all the ingoings and outgoings of the empire?
Like a lot of the ancient civilizations we've looked at, the Romans were yet again well ahead of their time, militarily, economically, and almost anythingly speaking. Thanks to this, we actually know a lot about them. Although their reports about themselves are obviously somewhat biased, they kept meticulous records of their battles, quests, and many more. Because of this, we know stories of how they struggled to defeat naked, barbaric British beasts. We know how they slayed Jesus Christ. And we also know the makeup of a lot of Europe and Britain 2,000 years ago, which is obviously very interesting. Their infamous decline was obviously succeeded by the Dark Ages, a period of almost no known historical significance, where hardly anything was documented and no major advancements were made, which again just goes to emphasize how advanced the Romans really were. As soon as they fell, nothing happened.
Yeah, I was going to say, if we continue on this vein of going through history, the Dark Ages should be quite a boring podcast. You know, struggle for topics there.
Yeah, I actually, after we've spoken about the Dark Ages a bit in some of the other podcasts, just because we find it so crazy that you had, you know, the Egyptians, the Greeks, the Romans, all at a similar time, and then nothing. And I did a bit of research, and there's genuinely just absolutely nothing. Like, we don't know anything. We don't know what they ate. We don't know what they wore, just because nothing has ever been documented about it. And I don't know if that's because, you know, it's been eradicated from history. Like, obviously, there's many famous instances of civilizations just removing everything about what came before. Like, the Spanish destroyed all the information about what happened in South America. But yeah, the Dark Ages is just a weird one. And maybe there's something deep and dark that they don't want us to know, and there actually are some really good conspiracies to come out of that.
Stay tuned.
Yeah. I guess it's the best case for a conspiracy, really, because nothing can be proven to be true. So you can't say anything and it could be true.
Just turned into a massive game of conspiracy.
So, yeah, the Romans were also the architects of their own downfall, as greed and corruption among the politicians caused unrest in many of their colonies, resulting in mass uprising that unfortunately no turtle-shaped shield formation could beat. With all great empires come great conspiracies and mysteries, and the Romans are no different, as Callum is going to prove to you now.
Yes, thanks for that, Luke. So my conspiracy or theory, mystery, whatever you want to call it, could be one of the hottest things to be coming out of Rome, if you'll pardon the pun, which will soon become apparent as I get into it. So as we're talking about the Roman Empire, what better place to start this podcast than the city from which the age took its name, Rome? Traditional accounts of the city's birth recall the tale of Romulus and Remus, the twin brothers that were raised by a she-wolf, not Shakira, unfortunately.
Before we move on a bit, obviously Rome is the home of the Romans, but I was doing a bit of research for this episode. Do you, either of you, happen to know what the home of the Holy Roman Empire was for, I think, almost 100 years?
No, I couldn't possibly tell you, which shows how my research didn't go that deep.
I mean, weirdly enough, it was the Reichstag in Berlin, of all places.
Oh, well, I mean, you could notice some. I don't know if it's historical significance or not, but the Romans like their eagles, and the Nazis definitely had eagles. They also had similar big staff things they'd walk and march with on their processions. So,
I mean, that completely blew my mind, because, I mean, you don't really think of Germany as a Catholic country. I think up until the 1600s it was, but it is very interesting. The Holy Roman Empire and the Reichstag, followed by a rather famous Austrian man a few hundred years well, many hundred years later.
That is interesting as well, because you never really think, well, at least I don't really think of Germany when you were thinking about, say, the Roman Empire, the Greeks and stuff, despite being one of the biggest powers in the world now.
Yeah. I think when we learn about the Romans here, like, you learn about it from a British perspective, but I think it was actually kind of German tribes that kind of caused the downfall of the Roman Empire more than anything else.
Yeah, there's definitely some wars between them.
Mm.
But yeah, back to my mystery. Let's go. So we're talking about Romulus and Remus. Probably everyone's heard this story. Legend says that the two brothers decided to build a city, and that's definitely what I would call a can-do attitude, so some real initiative.
How long did it take to build? Was it one day, Bernie?
I don't know. But...
Rome wasn't built in a day, Luke.
That was
exactly completely over my head. Well, it might have taken twice the time, because apparently the brothers had a bit of an argument, and one killed the other. Potentially over the naming rights to the city, because it was Romulus who ended up killing Remus. And as a result, Rome was named Rome after Romulus. So maybe it was built in 2 days, given they only had 50% of the manpower.
Sounds a bit better, Rome, than Reem. That's something curious
it says. The Essex Empire. Yeah. God help us all. Archaeological research can trace the city's origins back approximately 14,000 years, with excavations revealing tools, pottery and weapons that suggested Rome grew from simple settlements on the Palatine Hill, built above the area of the future Roman Forum, which is basically their big government buildings. From these humble beginnings, its transition into a decadent metropolis made it the focal point for the Roman Empire, featuring grand palaces, theatres and, of course, the famous gladiatorial arena and amphitheatre, the Colosseum. Therefore, when considering a city with such a rich and long-standing historical legacy, you might be surprised to learn that it's endured as many as 7 devastating fires during the early times of the Roman Empire. The first fire occurred in AD 6, with the aftermath leading to the creation of the cohorts vigiles, or the Roman fire department, in layman's terms. You'd think they'd have learnt their lesson, but alas, several fires followed in the years of AD 12, 14, 22, 26, and 36. Which destroyed many famous buildings and vital parts of Roman society.
So there were actually started being more fires when they got their own fire department rather than...
Could be a case of, have you heard of, police was creating crimes, they can go out and solve them themselves, yeah. Lathering with the fires.
I mean, I know the Romans like were incredible at building stuff like aqueducts and stuff like that and had a full water system, but I mean, I just can't imagine them being good at fighting fires. Like, to do it in today's time, you need a massive hose that can squirt water at, like, 100 miles per hour. I just imagine them, like, with a bucket, like, trying to throw it over the fire.
Who's the strongest one you can throw this furthest? But yeah, their obsession with aqueducts is quite fascinating to me. Like I say, it was almost described, I think, as some of the recounts I was reading, that it was seen as a bit ostentatious to be going out to build an aqueduct, so... They were just channeling taxpayers' money to build aqueducts, which people didn't like, despite it probably helping them.
They used to tax everything as well, which is probably why people just fed up. Like, I saw they tax like urine, which is just ridiculous.
Jesus, I thought having to ask the teacher in school to go to the toilet was bad enough. At least I have to pay for it.
If you're like low on money, you just hold it in, wreck your kidneys.
No. Yeah, so as you're saying, fire number 7 is the most important one of these famous fires. That's one I'll be focusing on as part of my theory today. In Latin, it is known as Incendium Magnum Romae, or the Great Fire of Rome. So number 7, lucky for some, but perhaps not for Nero, the reigning emperor at the time, or so you'd think. But before we get into that, let's dig a bit more into the history surrounding Emperor Nero, who I'm sure you've both heard of, as he's one of the most infamous emperors of the Roman Empire.
Of course I know him. He's that bloke who won 1,000 gold medals, wasn't he, at the Olympics?
Exactly. So yes, not many of our regular people know he made his debut appearance on the Cocos Brutus podcast in our fan favourite game of conspiracy. So tune into our previous episode on the Greeks to hear a bit about some of his many fantastic deeds.
I find that even weirder, because at the time it didn't click for me that it was the Roman Empire Nero. I just thought he was a Greek bloke, but you know, the Romans are interacting with Greece to that extent that the Greeks are so scared of them they have to give this guy 1,000 gold medals.
I guess it was just the power struggle, it was the changing of hands, the passing of the baton, to use an Olympic
analogy.
Yes, yeah, that's the one. An Olympic analogy, thanks for that. So Emperor Nero, he's definitely written himself into the Roman history books. In many ways, mostly wrong, I think, opinion would decry. So, to start things off, he was allegedly born feet first, which was considered an ominous sign at the time, which may have foreshadowed some of his later actions, especially in the eyes of his many detractors. Despite a promising start as emperor, he took to the throne at the tender age of 16, having studied under the tutelage of renowned Stoic Lucius Annaeus Seneca. Nero soon abandoned his Stoic sensibilities and descended into a life of debauchery and tyranny. He did, in his early years, oversee military success in several campaigns, treating for peace with the Parthian Empire, previously embittered enemies of Rome, crushing a rebellion in Britain led by none other than Queen Boudica herself, and also annexing the Bosporan Kingdom. Of course, as we discussed on the last episode, Nero wasn't actually present for any of these events, just took the credit for him for his great work with his generals, as he was more suited to the pursuits of the arts and was a renowned poet, singer, and musical instrumentalist. He would host performances and recitals, which traditionalists thought undermined his status as emperor, but initially made him popular with the common folk. However, his descent into tyranny definitely dispelled some of this popularity, and was thought to have been catalyzed by the death of his mother, for which some historians believe Nero may have been responsible, especially as they've also alleged that he was having an affair with her.
These bloody Romans, man.
It gets better. I say it gets better. It gets more debauched. So he had a period of cruelty during which he killed many dignitaries, foiled a conspiracy against him, and also kicked his wife to death, all while living a life of increasing decadence and luxury at the expense of the Roman people.
I'm pretty sure that incest is still legal in Italy. I think the term that the Italian laws have is it's legal as long as it doesn't cause a national scandal. Which would seem like it's probably been passed down from Roman times. I mean, that might be outdated, but I do remember seeing that. And I think that sums up Italian as well. Everything's legal as long as it doesn't cause a national scandal. That's Berlusconi would
say. Bunga bunga.
Apparently, in his grief, after realizing what a terrible deed he'd done in killing his wife, he decided to marry a younger boy who resembled his wife, whom he hated. Yeah, basically, let your imagination do the rest.
I've never heard that before, sadly.
He seems like a bit of a nut job. I guess that's what living a life of extreme power does. So, many historians also believe that the Great Fire of Rome, which I just mentioned, or previously mentioned, may also have been a key turning point in Nero's reign, as it represented a period of enforced change for the city of Rome, perhaps envisioned by the emperor himself, if certain accounts are to be believed. According to the renowned Roman historian Tacitus, the fire was said to have started in merchant shops, selling what were described as flammable goods. The shops were located near the chariot racing stadium known as Circus Maximus, and spread quickly. Strong winds fanned the flames, and civilian houses close to where the fire broke out were also packed together, badly constructed, and timber-framed, providing ample fuel for the fire to burn during the dry summer conditions. Tacitus documented that efforts to douse the fire were hindered by gangs of looters and arsonists who menaced the firemen and encouraged the blaze to spread. When the fire was finally contained, 3 out of Rome's 14 districts had been completely devastated, and a further 7 had been burnt to near destruction. The fire had lit up 2/3 of Rome, killing hundreds, left thousands more homeless, and destroyed some of Rome's greatest architecture, including the Temple of Jupiter Stator and the House of the Vestals. Now, you might be asking, where was Nero during all this? There are several claims to his whereabouts.
Shagging his mum.
Well, I'd hope not. None of the accounts mention that, fortunately. But say, as our friend Tacitus claimed, the emperor was away from Rome at the time, staying in the coastal city of Antium. However, Tacitus does also imply that the looters who aided the spread of the fire might have been doing so under Nero's orders, as he claims that looters said they were acting under orders, but they wouldn't say who. So it's all a bit up in the air. But other historians, known as Suetonius and Cassius Dio, are stronger in their convictions, believing that Nero was responsible for the fire, as he wanted to burn down parts of the city that he disliked so that he could build a lavish palace in their place. Other accounts state that Nero was giving a sermon, he was putting on a musical performance where he was playing the lyre and singing about the fall of Troy. That definitely does seem like, if you put your conspiracy hat on, some sort of cruel foreshadowing of the fate he was dealing to the Roman people.
Don't say I didn't warn you.
Yeah, that's why
you say he burnt it down to build a palace. Didn't you say the fire destroyed like 2/3 of Rome, which obviously wouldn't have been as big as it is today, but that's one big palace.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because it destroyed his own palace, which is actually the only reason he decided to come back to Rome in the first place, when he heard the news that, oh, your palace has been destroyed. So you think, yeah, as one mighty palace, as I will go on to mention, he did build several things in his name in the aftermath of the fire, which may or may not have angered the common folks. It was quite ostentatious. But initially, when he did hear the news, he came back to Rome and acted in a way quite befitting of a benevolent emperor. He opened up the other buildings that were still standing in the gardens to the homeless, building temporary structures, ordering extra supplies of food, and lowering the price of grain, and maybe an attempt to generate favour. His reconstruction plan for the city also included measures to build houses out of brick and space them out to prevent further such tragedies. However, the rumour mill was already starting to spin. Despite these good deeds, rumours were starting to circulate among the higher folk, or the more higher society that disliked Nero for his, basically his decadence, and thinking, I want some of that. And they also did tax the upper class quite a lot as well to generate funds for his extracurricular activities. So while these good deeds did seem like they were helping out the people in the short term, their favour was short-lived and rumours began to spread about how Nero himself may have been the architect of the fires, or it might have been his plan or his order to light the torches. This would cause Nero's nasty side to rear its ugly head once more. Certain historians, Tacitus included, recall that Nero needed a scapegoat for these fires and chose to blame the Christian population, a group whose religious beliefs had seen them marginalised and generally disliked by higher Roman society. So this, when combined with the news that Nero had built a new palace on the ashes of the burnt down buildings, as well as a 98-foot tall bronze statue of himself, landscape gardens, vineyards, and even an artificial lake. So this definitely soured public sentiment towards him. So Nero definitely needed someone to blame as the rumours were getting stronger that he was the one who started the fire in order to redesign Rome in his name. And I think there's also certain historians believe that he wanted to rename Rome after himself, but that never quite stood the test of history.
What would he have called it? Gnome?
So I don't think God and gnomes were a thing back in ancient. So he might not have seen the irony of that as we do now, but imagine thinking of the greatest empires of the world called the Gnome Empire.
We've got the Mongol Empire. I think the Gnome Empire would go quite well. Oh, if only the Gnome Empire could have lasted a bit longer, the battle between the gnomes and the Mongs would have been incredible.
No wonder aliens haven't invaded just yet. Mongs and gnomes. So as we were saying though, Nero needed a scapegoat to avoid accusations of conspiracy, so he singled out the Christians, as it was quite a fringe religion compared to the polytheistic religion practiced by the majority of Rome. Also, Tacitus was seen quite high in his contempt for the Christians, writing that they were believers in a most mischievous superstition that had spread to Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their centre and become popular. Historians have also suggested that earlier Christians in Rome believed the city to be an evil place, since they regarded the majority of the citizens to be pagans, which is basically evidenced widely throughout their society, believing in multiple gods, similar to the Greeks.
Yeah. Well, if Nero was married to a bloke, then it seems that, you know, Romans were a bit more progressive than Christians at the time. And I mean, obviously he's not gonna lie to them if they're saying you can't be married to this young man anymore.
I suppose, but it's being married to a man in a mutually agreed arrangement. There's another thing, castrating him and forcing him to be a wife.
Yeah, there's progressive, then there's that. I think they're two opposite sides.
Yeah, I probably worded it a bit wrong there. But
yeah, I suppose your point does stand. He did represent a side of debauchery and general. Exactly, yeah, one of the seven deadly sins. And he certainly did a lot of the other sins as well in his time. So Christians were definitely judging him, despite being maybe on the fringe sides of the Roman population. And also, interestingly, Christians had prophesied that the city would be set ablaze by a great inferno. So when the inferno seemingly did come, many Christians might have regarded it as the start of this last judgment, and therefore refrained from helping put it out. Which is a bit of martyrdom, I guess. If you're seeing the city burning around, you refuse to take action because you believe it's God's judgment.
But if it was God's judgment and he decided he was going to make Rome burn, I don't think you'd be able to put it out with a bucket and spade.
Good point. And I suppose also they would be in the belief that they were the righteous ones and God would save them from the deadly flames, but who knows? It's not 100% known whether Nero targeted the Christians to deflect the blame of this fire or whether he used the tragedy to start his persecution of them. But what is known is Nero's cruel and barbaric torture, which saw Christians seized and tortured into confessing, then torn to pieces by dogs, crucified or burned alive and used as human torches at night. This would cause a Christian text of the second century to proclaim that Nero was the Antichrist. And based on these recounts, you can understand why. Pretty nasty stuff. But to summarise, as with most history, despite the Romans being quite good at documenting what went on with their battles and their accountancy and what have you, you still do get conflicting accounts from different historians with different views using different records, etc.
I think it is really biased because is it Tacitus who was...
Yeah.
If his mates were Nero, he's going to be biased towards Nero, and Nero's telling him what to write down as well, so... It's always going to be a bias.
Yeah, some of his writings were almost, like, I don't want to take sides, but it's pretty clear that Nero is the one who's paying me wages. I think a quote was, both sides will tell their story or something along those lines. Or we've heard accounts from both sides, but, and then going on to say, yes, Nero was where he was, etc.
I might have missed this, but is there, like, what's the official cause of it? Like, what do the history books say caused it? Or is there not one?
There's not really an official consensus. Not really a consensus. Say, you know, the London, even with the Great Fire of London, you think there was it the bakery?
Pudding Lane.
Yeah, Pudding Lane. That seemed like cause. It just said it started in a nearby merchant shop selling flammable goods. So, I mean, that does ring a few alarm bells just to start. I don't know if the flammable goods description was just all merchant shops would be selling clothes and stuff. They're naturally quite flammable. Or if it was a shop just for explicitly flammable goods and nothing else.
Lighters and petrol.
But I think, okay, rumour mill and recounts that say that they saw people with torches just going out and setting the city ablaze, and people suggesting that they saw fire starting in houses several streets away from where the actual flame started. I think it's an unnatural spread of the fire, but then that can be accounted for by sparks carrying them on the wind, and it's not going to methodically work its way street through street in a nice block system as you get in Milton Keynes. But yeah, so what we do know is that there was a big fire, and it doesn't really paint Nero in a good light, regardless of the viewpoint you take, given that he was away playing his lyre and singing about the fall of Rome, if you believe that one. Another account, even more damning, suggests he was standing on a hill overlooking Rome, serenading the fire as it burned.
That does look good, actually.
Slightly hyperbolic, based upon like the Chinese whispers way of how history spreads throughout the common folk.
Imagine a press conference, like Monday press conference after the fire. Nero, can you explain why you were singing and dancing after the fire as your city burnt to the ground?
Fire? What fire? I didn't see any fire. I was so caught up in my performance. It's just the fire from the flames of my bars I was spitting. Tacitus wrote was that Nero only returned from his staying on the coastal city of Antium on holiday, but he only returned, which seems a bit futile to return when you hear the news that your city is, or your palace especially, has now been, the flames have reached it and it is now burning down. So what are you going to do when you get there? You're not exactly going to put the flames out yourself, are you? And although he did seem to act in a way as an emperor should and offer support to the homeless and the ones that have been displaced, while it might have been a way to usher in his new gnome, as we put it, new vision of gnome. But it's also worth noting on the flip side that should Nero have wanted to do an act the grandest of grand designs, he could have just done it without burning the city down, since he owned most of Rome, being the emperor. Requisitioning the areas for building would not have been too big of a task, and you wouldn't exactly need much planning permission, and also might have kept the favour of many of the population, given he didn't burn them to death.
I mean, yeah, I can empathise with him to some extent, because I suppose you would, if you don't want public opinion to turn against you, it looks a lot better if it's an accidental fire than you just demolishing houses and building stuff.
Yeah, I think Rome, I don't know what year this was actually, but Rome was pretty democratic towards its later stages, and the fact that there was like elections and stuff, so you couldn't really afford to piss the people off too much.
So the 90-day notice for the Roman bulldozers coming.
It's just unfortunate that someone was on the hill with him. He thought he was alone, but
yeah.
In the end.
There's a secret retreat. You've got there's a spy amongst the feeding news back to the people. You must have think though, if he's away, how long would it have taken words to reach him that, or your city's on fire? Because the fire, I think, it burned for 9 days in total.
Well, that's the thing.
Depends how far away he was, to be honest.
It doesn't take news that long to reach just up the hill, does it?
No.
So we can shout it out, Nero, your fire city's burning. I know it's beautiful. Look at it. Right, so I'll draw this conspiracy to a close then with the statement that, say, there's no doubt that Nero did benefit from the fire, but whether it was through sheer luck or an ever-growing streak of evil, I suppose only the man himself would know the truth. and such a secret would be taken to the grave with him, one that he's believed to have ordered his servants to dig for himself before committing suicide at the grand age of 30. Did he order his men to light the fire while he entertained his guests with the dulcet tones of the fall of Troy? Was the fire a convenient accident that allowed him to enact his plans for a big redesign of Rome and also enable him to persecute Christians as a sort of kill two birds with one stone? So Emperor Nero, twisted fire starter or misunderstood artist, who also happens to be a bloodthirsty tyrant? You decide.
Yeah, I'll start. I think it's a really interesting one, and you know, it's taking the most the most famous empire of that generation or that era, and also one of the most famous emperors in Nero, and also you got a bit of Christianity thrown in, a massive fire, a potential rebuilding of one of the most infamous cities of all time in Rome. So yeah, it's really interesting, and I find the Romans in general very, very interesting, just because, you know, there's a lot we do know about them. So it's one of them eras in history where it's so, so long ago, but you actually do know quite a bit about it. So I've always been interested in it, so I'm gonna go for a 9 out of 10. In terms of believability, I find it relatively believable that Nero started the fire. I think Rome and the higher circles of Rome was a very dog-eat-dog world. You know, people would do anything to become emperor or have more power. And, you know, you mentioned Nero was an artist and won Olympic gold and stuff like town planning or whatever. So probably wanted his own go at town planning, as he, you know, didn't see the city fit the way he wanted to. And he just wanted to rebuild it with statues of him and all that. And given that he committed suicide at 30 and other instances in his life, he was obviously a very power-driven, crazy man, as many of the emperors of Rome turned out to be. So I would not put it past him at all. And obviously we know that the Romans hated the Christians, as in a way a Christian empire was becoming a challenge to the Roman Empire. So yeah, I think I find it quite believable. I'm going to go for a 6 out of 10 that Nero was the one who started the fire. 6 out of 10, and then 4 out of 10 that it was Billy Joel who started the fire.
Nero, one who provided the spark.
Yeah.
What about you, John?
Yeah, so I really enjoyed this one too. I mean, it sounds like it was quite a big historical event. If you take the conspiracy side out of it, it sounds like it should be quite well known, really. And it's not something I was particularly aware of. But yeah, I found it really interesting as a whole. So I'm going to give the overall theory an 8.5, I think. In terms of believability, I'm not really sure. I mean, you know, the fact that he was said to openly dislike parts of Rome, and then when it all was sort of destroyed, he then builds this huge extravagant palace, I think perhaps does tell you what he thought of Rome in the first place and of his people and their money that he was spending. So I suppose you can't put it past him in that respect.
Yeah, it's pretty convenient that he happened to have perfectly drawn up plans of how he wants his new Rome to look like just after the city has been burnt to a crisp. So what do you think, guys? Anyway, guys, here's something I made earlier.
But then, sort of as we touched on earlier, it seems like, I don't know, is it the most efficient way of doing it? As you said, he sort of owned it all anyway. He could have just gone about the other way, even though the public probably wouldn't have looked at him as favourably. You know, he'd probably say he's innocent because he wasn't there, but I think he's more suspicious by his absence, because it's almost as if he was trying to force the issue of an alibi and by not being there. So I think that perhaps makes him look a bit more guilty. And then could he have used the Christians as scapegoats, especially with the fact that they, you know, didn't help putting it out because it was God's wishes and all this? I think it kind of adds up to be reasonably convincing and compelling. So I'm going to go 6.5 for believability, I think.
Yeah, just building that. It's almost like it's quite a well thought out crime, if you consider it a crime. It's well thought out, but you can still poke holes in it. So
I have this thought as well. You don't really never know how far a fire is going to spread. I mean, imagine if they started it in his palace, because they're like, well, we've got to burn your palace down. And then it didn't spread anywhere else. And all he's done is burn his own palace down.
He finds out the news 10 days later as well. Like, yeah, all you managed to do is burn your own palace.
So if I have to scale back those redesign plans just a little bit, just a 30-foot bronze statue instead of the 98-foot tall one.
Yeah, that is massive, actually. I didn't appreciate that when you first said it. That's huge.
It's incredible. You say it every single time, but it's incredible what they were able to build back then. Some of these structures and stuff, you know, very impressive engineering techniques. Thinking that, say, us Brits, we're living in our mud huts and bathing in muddy bogs and lakes, whereas the Romans are having grand palaces, amphitheatres, coliseums, aqueducts, etc., etc. So just quickly, because I'm aware that I've been speaking for quite a while, I'll try to wrap this up nice and quickly, well, quickly by my standards, if regular listeners will attest. I really enjoyed learning about this one. It went down quite a few more avenues than I originally expected when I first found this theory, given how notorious Nero was for being a bit of a dislikable fellow. Despite many historical accounts, especially in his earlier years as emperor, finding that the public could find him quite relatable, given that he gave public performances and sang and performed, recited poetry and won many an Olympic gold. He was a man of the people until death of his mother. And also, just as Luke was saying, there's many different elements there that got the religious aspect of Christianity being made the scapegoat while Nero is concocting his grand plan to redesign Rome in his image. And also, as John mentioned, it's quite almost convenient he wasn't there while the fire was taking place. But as for a rating, I'm going to go for a solid 8 out of 10. I think it was a solid conspiracy, and there's definitely a lot of questions that could be raised if we could go back in time to find the exact historical records. And that's the thing, we have sort of conflicting viewpoints from people who may or may not have been on Nero's payroll to recount his history and tenure as Roman emperor in the most, well, most favourable light, given his many, many crimes against many, many people. But I personally think that it almost seems too good to be true, a fire just starting out of nowhere that burns down the area of the city that you want to rebuild on. And you've also arranged a holiday to coincide with the, yes, it was a summer period, and the winds and dry temperature made the timber nicer and prone to be lit up by an unsuspecting fire, a convenient fire in the store of flammable goods. And also you've got all your lackeys going out telling people, or harassing the firefighters, telling them, maybe that's just the Christians out there who are the ones going after the firefighters, the ones putting their lives on the line to try and chuck the water on, and in the very futile attempts to preserve as much of the city as they can. But just, again, with most of history, there's so many differing accounts. And yes, people who were out preventing the firefighters from doing their work said they were acting on orders. No one has been able to ascertain whose orders they were. Maybe they were just drunks and out to cause a bit of a ruckus, which got out of hands. Maybe that's what originally caused the fire. We may never know. But I think Nero seems like such a cruel enough and sadistic man that he would have done whatever he could to further his own goals. And if that was redesigning the city of Rome into the grand empire of Nome, so be it. So I'm going to give it a 7 out of 10 for believability.
Did you say it took him 9 days to get back?
There was 9 days that the fire was burning for, so I'm not sure how long it would have taken based on the geography of
Rome. I've just had a look, and his holiday home is literally about as close to Rome as it's possible to get. some nice caves of Nero in the area now, so check them out, although apparently the restaurants nearby are expensive.
Worth it, I think.
I don't know if that's by Nero's design or not.
We're walking by in Nero's footsteps to see what's going on there, see if he become a terrifying, tyrannical emperor or not. But yeah, now you've mentioned that it was quite close, it does seem a little bit more believable that he was the one who started the fires just out of the way of it, so it couldn't have possibly spread to him. He was close enough there to quick, right, I'll act as a good emperor, open up the remaining palaces and gardens to the people. And while you're there, I'll drop the bombshell that, yeah, sorry, your city's getting redesigned and it's all going to look a bit more like me. So following that rather flammable mystery, Luke, have you got an equally hot offering?
Given it's involving Scotland, it's going to be relatively cold.
Oh, icy.
Yeah, thanks for that, Callum. And I'm going to be talking about something that has totally disappeared, much like the Mary Celeste and Chelsea's title chances in the last four or so seasons. And that is the Roman 9th Legion. So this legion was actually one of the most experienced and feared legions in the entirety of the Roman Empire. They boasted an array of successful victories on their curriculum vitae. Do you like what I did there? Made sure to get the Latin in.
Did not go unnoticed.
From being Caesar's go-to legion to helping Octavian take down Mark Antony and Cleopatra. They helped conquer Spain and North Africa in the Roman name and were given the task of finalizing the Roman takeover of Britannia, quelling the uprisings of famous people like Boudicca, amongst others, and also claiming the parts that were yet to be claimed. So in 61 AD, the 9th were famously ambushed and defeated by Queen Boudicca in a rebellion against Roman rule. The legion lost a lot of men, but did manage to escape. The Romans then eventually quashed the rebellion, and over the years built up the 9th legion once again to be the all-powerful, all-conquering army it really was. And then 21 years after the devastation against Boudicca, the 9th went from strength to strength, comfortably holding Britannia, specifically modern-day England and Wales, as they never really got Scotland in the name of the Roman Empire.
Hadrian's Wall wasn't built for nothing.
It's about a foot high.
So the 9th marched into Scotland in 82 AD and this is the last they were ever heard of. They attempted to defeat the Scottish or Caledonian tribes, as they were better known, but were unsuccessful. The Scottish defeated them in battle, but the ninth were supposedly saved by other Roman legions, and that was that. That's all we know. They were never mentioned again in Roman literature. One of the blazing emblems of Roman military, their pride and joy, just simply disappeared. Was the embarrassment of their annihilation by the Scots too much for the Romans that they themselves disbanded the ninth to avoid a never tale of military weakness that could inspire further uprisings across the empire? Or could it have actually been that the Scots completely wiped out the ninth and the Roman tales of the battle were falsified to stop panic that the Roman Empire was weak enough to lose a battle to a bunch of barbarians? Because, you know, all our tales of Roman history, they come from Roman stories, like Tacitus is a famous scribe, and the Romans were likely to be biased towards themselves. And if they had lost in the battle to the Scots and the Ninth Legion was totally wiped out, rather than actually bothering to say, oh yeah, we lost the entire legion in a battle against some guys who don't even know how to wear clothes.
they knew how, they chose not to.
we'll instead just write that they were losing and they got saved and all was good. The other Roman legions came and rescued them because they can beat the Scottish.
I suppose either way you look at it, it doesn't really paint the this Ninth Legion in the best light, considering how highly organized we were led to believe the Roman military was and how effective their tactics were at conquering swathes of Europe. They come up against kilts wearing maniacs, but probably very little organization whatsoever, just charging into battle and completely crumble.
Yeah, I think the thing is as well with a lot of these tribes is that they actually had a very, very different dialect, so they couldn't even communicate that well with each other, and they're using like guerrilla warfare as in a way to just defeat one of the greatest militaries of all time, a military that was well ahead of its game and had incredible tactics, but you know, they just kept losing to the Scottish people.
I suppose you've mentioned a football analogy at the start. Use another one, sort of trying to play a tiki-taka against Stoke on a cold, wet, rainy night. It's just a complete culture clash that just doesn't work. You're expecting to play against a team that comes out against you in a conventional way and you can pass your way through them. If they're coming from left, right, all sorts of angles, hiding in bushes and bogs and pouncing and you're weighed down with heavy armour.
I guess as well, we have seen like this David and Goliath story as before as well, because this is what it is. It's a David and Goliath story, really. You know, the Romans were so much better equipped. But then I guess in history, you've got the Boer War and you've also got the Vietnam War, which are prime examples of this, like being better equipped and tactically better doesn't actually make you win, especially when you're like going away to another place that you don't know as well as the local people.
Yeah, that's true. That's another thing, fact we got to take into account. They are quite far from home, relatively speaking, for the time, and it's a completely different climate. It might have been a bit cold.
Well, one interesting thing I found out is that in this period in Britain, it's 2 degrees Celsius hotter then than it is now. So, you know, I don't hear stories of the time of places being completely under the water and it was 2 degrees Celsius hotter. So there you go.
Kill two birds with one stone yet again. We've debunked climate change and also explored history.
No wonder the Romans wanted to go. Cornwall absolutely booming in the summer. But yeah, if this were to be the case and the Romans were to make it up, in the sense that the ninth was actually destroyed and the Romans decided not to write that and they lost to the Scottish, surely it would be known in the Roman political upper echelons, and therefore this would probably make the Romans build a massive wall or something to stop the people who killed their hardest soldiers coming to fight them again.
Well, as we said earlier, they built a wall. It wasn't necessarily a massive one. I don't think your average Scot's going to have too much trouble traversing that.
This is the thing. Either leprechauns are real and they're in Scotland, or that wall was disintegrated a lot, surely.
I think it must have been bigger than it is. Because it's so
the Romans, we know, are capable of building incredible architecture. And I don't believe they're going to build a wall and make it like easily scalable to the extent you can literally just step over it. Have either of you been to Hadrian's Wall before?
Yeah.
A long time
yeah,
ago.
I visited as well. And yeah, I think I was like a 5-year-old and I could climb it at the time. So.
But even if it's completely eroded over 2,000 years or whatever, there's got to be some elements of bits falling off and stuff. I don't know. It's not going to completely vanish, if you get my drift.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it's just a kind of symbol and the Romans manned it. So, I mean, it was so easily scalable and it was so long that I don't know if it was possible to completely man it, to be honest. So I don't really understand what the point of it was, but... Maybe it's just a symbol that, you know, don't cross this wall. This is where, maybe for themselves, like, don't go past this point because you'll probably get killed by some guys in kilts.
Oh, maybe they had a conundrum. They either built the wall the entire breadth of Scotland or they built it really high in some places. They went for the former.
Yeah, Ben Nevis is actually one of the Roman walls. Not many people know. But yeah.
They wasted all of their stones on making Ben Nevis.
They could have just run out of stones. Good point. But yeah, if the official Roman accounts are true, then the Ninth Legion was saved in Scotland. And then if this is the case, what happened to them? Because as I mentioned, they completely disappeared from Roman literature. And there are a number of theories. One suggests that they were so scared of the Scots, they retreated to York and deserted, joining the British tribes, intermingling with the locals. And I guess we can be grateful that they didn't conquer Scotland and intermingle. Otherwise, gingers would probably be extinct by now because of that dominant brunette hair, blonde hair trait over the ginger hair. So thanks to the hardworking Caledonian tribes, gingers still exist.
Yeah, I don't want any of that Mediterranean genes infecting our Scottish blood.
And yeah, I don't think that's too unlikely. Many British tribes at the time swore allegiance to the Romans in return for favours by the Romans. And so the relationship between British women and the Romans in some areas could support this theory. Other accounts suggest that the Legion ended up in Armenia, of all places. A bit far from Scotland, but not too dissimilar. So in 161 AD, which is about 80 years after this battle, they lost to the Scots, which would be 80 years after they were last in Roman literature, which is a very long time considering the Romans did write down a lot. The commander Marcus Severianus led an unnamed legion into Armenia during a war with the Parthians. The result proved devastating. Severianus and his legion were annihilated by a Parthian army of horse archers near a town called Elegia. And no one in the legion survived. Now, could this unnamed legion have been the ninth? Did perhaps the Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius not wish to add such a tragic defeat and demise of this legion to their histories? And that's why we never heard from them again. The Romans hated to look weak. So again, this is quite plausible, but you know, 80 year gap in between the two wars. So you can kind of see why.
No wonder they lost the second time round. They're about 100.
I was going to come on to that as well. I was just thinking, surely they're bloody new soldiers. Maybe these the newer breed, the next breed, which is not as good as the grizzled veterans.
That's a possibility as well, I guess. This legion was around for hundreds and hundreds of years. And I mean, generation on generation, it could just be a completely different, really, couldn't it? And if they're going from, you know, they're our main legion to all of a sudden, oh, they're losing these battles to Boudicca, they're losing these battles to Scots, we're not going to put them in our main wars anymore, so just send over a load of dud soldiers to replace the ones we've lost in that legion or are getting a bit too old. So it's plausible, I guess. But yeah, the fact that the legion that marched into Armenia and got absolutely destroyed remains unnamed and is unnamed in the report of the battle kind of suggests very obviously that the leader at the time did not want this legion to be named. And I guess if that legion were to be the ninth, then yeah, that makes sense because, you know, it's one of their most famous legions. They don't want everyone to know that one of their most famous legions could lose so devastatingly in battle twice.
Twice, yeah. But I suppose it's really tarnished all of their other victories they've had within ninth or at their full strength. When we can say it's a changing of the guard, we've all got the 10th and the 11th legions to come and they'll...
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, you would expect some remnants of the 9th to have been found somewhere as well. As I mean, over the period of the 80 years, they've obviously marched from York or Scotland to Armenia, which is quite a walk. Not sure if you've ever tried that walk before. Not quite too pleasant, but yeah.
All related to Jesus, by any chance? They were about to walk across the channel.
Well, I'm assuming they took a boat, but you never know.
Planes.
Imagine if they did have planes, so that would be silly. This is actually the case, funnily enough, as there were remnants of the ninth found in Germany, and that was dated to around 120 AD, suggesting that at least some of the ninth made it there. However, given they were never mentioned again, clearly something happened, be it military disaster in Scotland, Armenia, or elsewhere. Personally, I prefer to opt for the story of gigantic Scotsmen that wiped out one of Rome's most battle-hardened legion, scaring the Romans so much that the main man Hadrian had to build a wall to keep the Scots out. What do you guys think?
Well, I suppose you can guess where I'm going to pledge my allegiances on this one. I'm very much going to plump for the idea that the Scots completely scared the pants off the Romans, shattered their tortoise formations and sent them packing over the wall, never to be seen again. And then the resulting embarrassment caused them to be scrubbed from the history books, and that's the last we'll ever hear of them. I do find it quite interesting that it seems like DNA and ancestry records do support the idea that Romans may have deserted and embedded themselves into British clans and just sort of...
Yeah, I think you can understand that. I mean, it must literally take, like, if you wanted to go back York to Rome, that's got to take, like, 4 months. Surely you're just like, nah, I literally can't be asked to go home. This woman's, like, semi-attractive, like she'll do.
Semi-attractive.
I ain't walking 4 months home with limited food and that.
Just don't want to face up to your parents with me laughter by the streets when the news reaches the common people. You've got to make your way up to see the Emperor to be debriefed.
Also, chances are on that four-month walk home to Rome, you probably get lost as well and end up in, like, bloody... I don't know. You could end up anywhere. I know that all roads lead to Rome, but you'd so easily get lost. Like, if that was me walking from York to Rome, I'd end up in, like, Wales, and it's completely wrong. And then once you're in Wales, it's like, oh, all of a sudden, I've lost my bearings. I don't have a clue how to get to Rome. I just wouldn't bother walking home. So, yeah, you can understand why they deserted.
There's also maybe fear of punishment from their superiors back in Rome, hearing that their favourite legion has gone off the boil.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Overall, I think it was a really interesting theory because it's quite a well-known one. The fate of the Ninth Legion is one of the biggest mysteries to have emerged from the Roman period. And of course, being quite close to home, both for Scotland and Britain, I'm going to give this one a solid 8.5 out of 10. I think it's quite strange how they were so dominant, so powerful, rock up to Scotland and never heard from again.
And then a wall was built.
Yeah. The correlation, causality, coincidence, what have you. Something's got to be lining up there. You don't just build a wall and waste all of those resources to block out a place.
I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that the Romans were scared of the Scottish. And they obviously felt that they couldn't take them on in battle. And I mean, whether that's because the Ninth Legion got completely destroyed by them or not is up for debate. But yeah, the Romans were genuinely so, so scared of the Scottish. Which is a huge respect because, you know, that's completely like... It's like when you got a Sunday league footballer who's smoking, having a pint before the game or whatever, and he's just there like whipping in free kicks left, right and centre. He's just not trying and he can beat one of the greatest of all time. But yeah,
I suppose just those knowing your surroundings, being confident in your own abilities, etc. And being your opposition, essentially the Romans being so far out of their comfort zone. Let's say no amount of military tactics could prepare you for a 6'4" naked man charging at you dressed head to toe in blue war paint with like no fear whatsoever, throwing military tactics just to the wind, essentially. And in terms of believability, I guess that maybe slightly biased, but I'm going to give it it's a solid, I'm going to say it's 9 out of 10 believability that the Scots were the reason that the Romans fled.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm definitely heart over head in this regard, but it's still, it made a compelling argument regardless of the fact that Hadrian's Wall was built and we don't hear from them again after they went to try and defeat the Picts in Scotland. But, you know, I still find it interesting as well. You think the culture divide between, or the culture clash between Romans and Brits, yet they're able to apparently trade and be accepted into these tribes. It's probably language barriers as well. It's really interesting.
Yeah, well, I don't know how it worked. I don't know if like Britain was speaking Latin under Roman rule or what, to be honest. I mean, the majority of the tribes in England and Wales especially ended up swearing allegiance to the Romans just for an easy life, really. And that's why these rebellions were quite easily quashed in England, just because there wasn't actually that many tribes that rebelled. So, but then Scotland seemed united.
Passionately anti-aqueduct.
Yeah. Yeah, what about you then, John?
Yeah, I really enjoyed this one as well. I think the idea of one of the most feared and successful battalions in the Roman Empire coming over Scotland and then leaving with their tail between their legs is quite appealing. So I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10 for the theory overall. In terms of believability, I'll lean more towards sort of just that they arrived, weren't prepared for what they got themselves into. And then I'd say they probably weren't wiped out completely, just because you said there were traces of that battalion founded like Germany and was Armenia, even though it was 80 years apart. I feel like if they were completely wiped out, you would have just got rid of the name sort of altogether. So I think there were probably some survivors that then managed to make their way back, you know, sort of embarrassed and defeated, but still made their way back. So believability wise, I'll probably go quite high as well. I think it certainly seems reasonable and it would make sense. So I'll go for an 8 out of 10 on believability.
Very nice. Yeah, I really enjoyed researching this theory. I've always found the Romans interesting, and tales of them being scared of the Scots always used to catch my eye, because, you know, what would make the Romans scared? They were just all being all conquering people, and yet they were scared of, you know, kind of a very comparatively primitive Scotsman. So yeah, I'm going to score it an 8 out of 10 as a theory. In terms of believability, yeah, it's a tough one. We know that the Romans were biased, very biased, and the fact that the Roman records state that the Ninth lost this battle goes to show you that they did, because, you know, they were super biased. They're saying they lost, which, if you translate it to the fact that it's already being biased by saying they lost, yeah, they probably did get completely annihilated and not saved like the records state. Because if they were saved, then you'd argue that there'd be more record of that. And if they were disbanded, you'd argue there'd be record of that as well. So, you know, the fact that they went and built Hadrian's Wall not long after as well suggests that they did fear the Scots because they wiped out the legion. In terms of what was found in Germany, I think, you know, it's dated to 120 AD, which is 40 years after the battle. But at the same time, can you be that precise when dating? I don't think you can. I think there's always give or take 100 years with something that's 2,000 years old, or in the case of the Sphinx, give or take 20,000 years. But yeah, and then Armenia, I think the Armenian one's interesting. I wouldn't be surprised if the Romans just didn't want to mention the legion full stop because they were that embarrassed by it. But, you know, that there's potential that that could be the Ninth. I guess it's a logical step. England, 40 years later Germany, 40 years later Armenia. It's possible. But yeah, I'm definitely opting for the theory that the Scots just completely wiped them out, and that's the reason why they're so scared of the Scots. So I'm going to score it 8.5 out of 10.
It's just on the Armenia one. Do you think that's maybe punishment further for their failure to Scotland? They don't get any of the glamorous locations. So no disrespect to Armenia, but so they got their mates off fighting in Greece. Sorry, no, you're shipping off to Armenia.
Well, you say that, but I feel like that's what Britain exactly was at the time. Britain was probably the place you didn't want to get sent because, you know, the Roman Empire probably engulfed Greece, Armenia, North Africa, and 2,000 years ago, they were probably much better than the mud hut should arrive at in Britain, and colder climate compared to the Mediterranean. So yeah, maybe Britain was their punishment, and then the next punishment was Armenia.
Well, they just, the Ninth themselves just got so fed up of being getting all the rubbish assignments despite being this glamorous fighting unit, they just gave up, didn't even bother trying to fight the Scots, and just decided to go join the British clans in rebellion.
Could be it.
I did have a similar thought on that, actually. I thought, you know, when like a Premier League footballer's struggling a bit, so you put them in against like Grimsby Town. I thought it was like, after they got battered by Scotland, they got sent to Armenia. Go and batter them, get your confidence up, and then come back. And then they ended up losing that as well.
It's time to retire the old Ninth Legion in that case.
Yeah.
Get them on punditry duty.
Yeah, that rounds up my theory on the Ninth Legion. John, what have you got for us?
Okay, yeah, so my theory is a bit different to the other two. So firstly, when we sort of think of Roman warfare and battles, you kind of think of swords, shields, gladiators, things like that. You know, hand-to-hand, close combat. Not particularly sophisticated weaponry, perhaps sophisticated tactics, but, you know, not too advanced, which is sort of what my theory is based on. So archaeology is quite tough sometimes, as it takes a little bit of effort to keep from viewing an ancient site through a modern lens and reading too much into something that seems transparent yet impossible for its time. But that said, it is apparently entirely possible that a 2,000-year-old find from a Roman city in Syria is an example of something very modern, and that is chemical warfare.
Chemical warfare.
No, very, very glamorous.
I suppose when you think of that, you do think of dirty bombs, things like that, just bombs filled with germs that they drop on the enemies. So maybe you could boil down a chemical warfare to a more primitive element, just send some guy around the enemy camp coughing should do the trick.
I mean, you're not a million miles away of the coughing part.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, archaeologists found the oldest evidence of chemical warfare in 2011 after studying the bodies of 20 Roman soldiers found underground in Syria 70 years ago. The bodies dated back to 256 AD. So according to University of Leicester archaeologist Simon James, his reconstruction of a battle that played out under the walls of Jura Europos suggests that the 19 Roman soldiers who died in the underground tunnels didn't actually die in a conventional battle, but they seem to have actually died by choking. Callum has sort of already called that part. So at the time, we know this Syrian city was held by Rome, and that attacking Persians started digging tunnels under the walls. Rome's defenders dug their own tunnels to intercept them, And as we're at a higher elevation.
Won't be the last time that chemical warfare is used in Syria.
Oh, Assad, if you're listening.
Some things have never changed.
Yeah. So when the siege tunnels were excavated in the 1920s and 30s, researchers thought that the tunnels met. So basically what they thought would happen is the two tunnels met, one with the Persians, one with the Romans. The men then fought when they met in the middle and died in what would have been a relatively standard Roman battle. But this archaeologist believes that wasn't actually the case. And the Persians actually let the Romans break through their tunnel. And once they were trapped inside, they set a deadly mix of bitumen and sulfur ablaze, traces of which were found in the caves upon excavation.
I mean, yeah, I wouldn't put it past them. Surely they're aware that there's certain materials that they can get, and, you know, that someone's probably accidentally licked it, eaten it, sniffed it, set it on fire, and they've realised, you know, we can use this. Oh, this is deadly. We can use this, so... It's very clever warfare to do that 2,000 years ago, for sure, but not implausible.
I'm trying to get my head around fighting in tunnels, though, because surely if you're in a tunnel, you've got your team of diggers, you've got a team of people setting up support.
It's a Greek labyrinth.
Right, okay, yeah, Syria, Greek, quite fairly close, yeah, I suppose. But it doesn't, I mean, I guess the whole point is trying to have the element of surprise and sneak attacks. But if both sides know you're digging towards each other, you're thinking, this battle's going to be a nightmare.
Imagine how easy it is to miss each other as well. Just like dig past
them. It's like a game of Snake, trying to follow each other around. But yeah, you've kind of touched on something I'm about to come on to, actually. So in this new interpretation of the clash in the tunnels, the Romans heard the Persians working beneath the ground. So that's when they built their own tunnel down and steered their tunnel to try and intercept the enemy Persians. So the Roman tunnel was a lot shallower than the Persian one because, you know, theirs was just sort of rushed. Just a case of let's get down there and stop them before they get up. To me, that doesn't make a great deal of sense anyway, because surely you just wait for them to come up and then get them there. You've got the high ground rather than going down to their level. But
never underestimate the high ground.
Curiosity killed the cat.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And the Romans planned to sort of build their tunnel on top of the Persians one and then break in on them from above. But as kind of touched on, there was no element of surprise for either side, because the Persians then heard the Romans digging down, so then dug theirs up to meet them. It's a bit of a...
I suppose they threw the planning and the tactics out the window. It's just reacting. Oh, we could hear them, but dig faster.
So rather than then sort of carry on building their tunnel and trying to meet the Romans in the middle, Persians instead quite cleverly decided to set a trap. Just as the Romans broke through, they lit a fire in their own tunnel and then bellowed to direct the smoke and also relied on the natural chimney effect between the two tunnels, with one being higher than the other. They then threw the sulfur and bitumen on the flames and quickly fled back out of their own tunnel. Of the 19 Roman soldiers who were digging their tunnel, all 19 died. Also, one of the Persian soldiers was overcome, caught in the flames and fumes, and also died, a victim of his own side's weapon.
I think that the Persians, like, they must have been pre-planning this in advance, knowing the Romans would maybe try and intercept them with their digging, to have a set of bellows already ready.
Yeah.
Man the bellows. Well, just before, actually, no, let's first of all, why are you bringing these bellows down with us? You're not, sorry, it updates the...
You'll see.
Do you not get the memo?
Yeah. I wonder if they were trying to go up into like a building or something, and then they would have lit it. But because the Romans came down, they accelerated that plan. But yeah, I'm not sure.
Interested though, yeah.
So the Romans were then met with this choking gas, which turned to sulfuric acid in their lungs, killing them.
Ooh.
It would have almost been literally the fumes of hell coming out of the Roman tunnel, said this archaeologist. Any Roman soldiers waiting to enter the tunnels behind their other men would have then hesitated, seeing the smoke and hearing their fellow soldiers dying. Meanwhile, the Persians waited for the tunnel to clear and then hurried to collapse the Roman tunnel, trapping the remaining soldiers inside. They also dragged the bodies of some of the Roman corpses into a stacked position to, again, block the doors and exits, which sounds a bit sick, really. And this is how they were later found.
Why do you think it's incredible this archaeologist has managed to come up with this series of events as a definitive explanation as to what happened in these tunnels?
Yeah, he's basically, they've found these two tunnels, that are, and then there's one that is above the other one. But some of the main clues are obviously they found the bellows.
Yeah.
They found the evidence of the like sulfur and the butamate in there. And they also found, more interestingly, all the corpses of the Roman soldiers were there. But they were left with all their coins, armour and weapons untouched, basically because the Persians wouldn't have been able to get in, loot them and get out, because they would have been gassed to death themselves.
Oh, that is incredible critical thinking, then. I like that.
Yeah.
Also, right, the Romans rocking up to the war with their purses and all their coins and stuff.
Alternatively, they couldn't make much use of the Roman coins and Persia, and if they went to Rome to spend them, they'd probably be killed.
So you should still melt them down or something. So, but I guess the archaeologists' line of thought makes quite a lot of sense. And I mean, we were able to paint maybe a bit more of a comedic side to the story. We had to paint a pretty vivid picture just from what we heard from John. So it's not beyond the realms of possibility that is exactly what happens.
No, definitely. I mean,
this guy studied history for several years and clearly knows his stuff.
Yeah, I think the evidence stacks up more in his favor than against his favor, for sure. But it's whether, you know, it's putting two and two together and getting six or getting four. That's the question.
Yeah, so in the like 20s and 30s, when it was first excavated, they just made the assumption it was a normal kind of tunnels meeting and then having a conventional battle, and that's how they died. But this new evidence over the last 10 years has made few people rethink. So it's obviously quite a gruesome way to die. You know, it's just described as a horrible death. The mixture would have produced toxic gases, including sulfur dioxide and heavy petrochemicals, causing the victims to choke, pass out, and then die.
Yeah, I was just saying, through the years, through the history books, we as humans have come up with some very creative ways to kill people.
Yeah, I know.
Vicious, horrible, gruesome endings some people must have met on the battlefield. Like trying to see, like, storm a castle wall to have burning pitch poured on you.
Yeah, yeah.
All manner of traps and stuff in the trenches in World War One. So we've got quite the imagination when it comes to ending people's lives.
Yeah, it was one of the only constants over all of human time is humans killing humans. So you're always going to get a bit more inventive.
Yeah.
So this is believed to be the oldest archaeological evidence of chemical warfare ever found. And as we've just touched on then, it's the beginning of a particularly nasty history of killing that continues up to the modern day. Sort of another piece of evidence that these soldiers didn't die by the sword or spear, but through asphyxiation, was that rather conveniently, one of the skeletons found is positioned as if he's clutching at his neck, sort of Darth Vader style.
Ooh.
Which is, again, made to think, you know, you're gasping for air. You kind of do have a tendency to clutch at your neck, even knowing it's not really going to do a great deal. Maybe cover your mouth.
Yeah, put your mask on, social distance.
Not sure that would have helped in this case.
Exactly. Probably would have done some good, to be fair. Well, the masks more than that. So these Romans had been part of a large Roman garrison defending the Empire outpost city of Dura Europos in modern-day Syria. And they'd had multiple ferocious sieges by the Persian Empire's army in around, you know, AD 256. But there are no historical texts describing these sieges. But following these excavations in the 20s and 30s, which have then again been renewed in recent years, they seem to have found a full range of ancient siege techniques the Persians used to break into the city, including these mining operations to dig under and breach the city walls. Romans seem to respond with these counter mines to thwart the attackers. So, as we touched on, sort of meeting them in the middle and stopping them before they can get under and breach the cities. But that proved to be these soldiers' downfall because Persians learnt from their mistakes.
And any evidence of giant wooden horses in amongst these siege tactics?
Not falling for that again.
No, not really.
So how do Romans like to build siege towers? I think they must be quite strange when you think of readying a battle. You see the Romans, like, builders rock up with wooden nails and hammers. Trying to be completely picked off by archers.
Yeah, you'd think so. So another reason they lean more towards this chemical warfare reason rather than traditional battle is that there are 20 corpses in a space less than 2 meters high or wide, about 11 meters long. But of those 20 corpses, only 19 of them were Roman, only one was Persian. So it's either like one incredible Persian fighter who really went down with a fight, 19 on one, and only just succumbed to it, or it was something a bit more complicated and perhaps the Persians weren't some like samurai level soldiers.
Just someone absolutely ape shit at this 2 meter ball.
It's a helicopter.
General Grievous techniques of 4 hours.
But this discovery has led archaeologists to believe that there might have actually been a lot more chemical warfare in the ancient world than we know about. And they say that few people are aware of just how much there is documented in the ancient historians about this. So another early example was a battle in 189 BC when the Greeks burnt chicken feathers and again used bellows to blow the smoke into Roman invaders' siege tunnels. And also petrochemical fires were a common tool in the Middle East, where flammable naphtha and again bitumen were easy to find. So these ancient militaries actually were a bit more creative than we thought they were. Also, when Alexander the Great attacked the city of Tyre in the 4th century BC, the defenders had a bit of a surprise waiting for him because they heated grains of sand in shields until it was white hot and then catapulted them down onto Alexander's army. So these tiny pieces of red hot sand went right under their armor, straight through the armor and a few inches into their skin, burning them. And almost acting like modern-day bullets. I guess
we can be grateful that these early kind of chemical warfare explorers were in places like Rome and Persia and not the Uzbeki or Kurzig Mountains where uranium was present, because zero AD nuclear warfare. I've got very interested.
It's completely, very, very much unrelated with uranium. Did anyone try to eat uranium? Because I saw somewhere, I don't know if it was an edited meme or something, but uranium's like 9 million calories per gram or something like that.
Just eat like a gram and then just literally blow up.
I don't understand how that works.
You just put 100 stones in one bite.
Someone's got to try that, please.
It's a horrible history of stupid death.
So, yeah, I mean, the idea that the Persians had learned how to make toxic smoke seems to become more plausible with the fact that it was being done even earlier, actually, than there are ancient history texts saying that Greeks used similar techniques like this against the Romans, using smoke generators in a tunnel. The only thing is this is the first physical evidence of it happening, whereas there is actually some texts and things saying it could have been happening even earlier. So, yeah, the main consensus was always that these Eastern empires weren't as good at siege warfare, but clearly these Persians were just as good as the Romans, if not better, really. So despite a lack of significant written down evidence of much more than traditional gladiatorial battles, did the ancient civilizations actually have far more sophisticated tactics than we give them credit for? And did an unlucky group of Romans fall victim to one of the earliest known cases of chemical warfare attack? What do you think?
Yeah, I think this one's really interesting, and it's rewriting history, which I love to hear about, you know, these previously unthought possibilities that were potentially happening way back then. And for that reason, I'm going to score it a 9 out of 10. In terms of believability, I don't think it's beyond the realms of possibility at all. You know, some of these great civilizations had incredibly intelligent scientists, philosophers, architects, you know, they're building these ridiculous things like the Colosseum. You're not telling me that they're not intelligent enough to be able to use chemicals and see the effects that they have when used and think, you know, actually this might be good to use against someone to kill them. So I don't think it's impossible. And in terms of kind of like the smoke, you know, fires happened all the time, as Nero proved. So I'm sure they could have worked out that, you know, sniffing or breathing in smoke can be very intoxicating and deadly. So yeah, again, putting two and two together, they could have very easily done it. Yeah, I think it's also something that's impossible to prove archaeologically because of, you know, the life and dating things like this. But this one archaeologist seems to have done a very good job to kind of tell a story of a possible case of it. Because realistically, I think no matter how great technology gets, it's going to be very hard to find definitive proof of this. So I'm happy to accept what we've got. And I'm going to score it a 7.5 out of 10.
Cool, thank you very much. Callum,
yeah, I think it's been a very compelling argument made by both by you and the historian who made these claims, this discovery. And I guess on the evidence we've been presented with, it's quite likely that some sort of, I don't know, toxic agent was released by these Persians, especially the Romans, as seen their skeletons found clutching their necks. Effectively, would be the position you'd be in if you were choking to death. And you've got, say, bellows being found, traces of sulfur and other toxic chemicals all comes together for a rather grisly end to these Roman soldiers. And just for the overall theory as well, the changing, almost changing our understanding of ancient warfare, I'm going to give it another really high mark. I'll give it a 9 out of 10 as well. I really enjoyed it. There's just a lot to dig into, if you'll pardon the pun, with these tunnels. So I'm still trying to get my head around the idea if you've got these two teams digging opposing tunnels. And, you'd be bricking it, I think, but you can hear the other one getting closer and closer. And when you see, what if the ground collapses beneath you, just fall headfirst onto these Persians who are ready to battle? There's got to be more effective ways to fight wars. But I suppose if you hold up in your castle, siege tactics have got to take over. But again, it's going to be another high believability for me as well, just based on the, scientific evidence behind it, the historical reasoning and clever archaeological analysis. It does seem like there was evidence of, as we said, I said earlier, just toxic chemicals, which turn you to sulfur or sulfuric acid in your lungs. Sounds like a nasty way to go. And we do know that humans are very adept at coming up with interesting ways to kill each other, especially in wars. And even stretching back to these early times, you think, normally you try and wait them out, but if you want to get things going a bit more, you dig your tunnels and now fill them with burning sulfuric acid. So I'm going to go for a 7 out of 10 on believability. I think those Persians knew a thing or two about the old chemistry.
Okay, cool. So I'll some good ratings there. I'll quickly rate it myself. I think in terms of the overall theory, I really enjoyed this one. I mean, like I sort of touched on, you think of like gladiators and traditional, close quarters combat and all that when you think of ancient Rome and the sieges and things. Never really would have considered that they could use basically, gassing someone. So I thought that was really interesting. So the overall theory, I'm going to give it a 8.5 out of 10. I think a little extra mile because it was the Romans getting defeated as a bit of a running theme in this podcast so far. And then believability. I mean, I was very convinced reading it, to be honest. As Callum touched on, the bellows and finding the traces of these chemicals. And then also text saying, it wouldn't be the first time it's been done, and it's been done even earlier. And, the Romans were so sophisticated, if you were going to overcome them, you probably would have to think outside the box, unless you were Scotland. So I think it probably did happen, and they probably did choose to gas them out. So I think believability-wise, I'm gonna go for a really high. I'm going to go for a 9 out of 10.
So maybe the Ninth Legion got done by chemical warfare as well.
Yeah. Don't rule it out.
So that brings us nearly to the end of the podcast. We're all done with our theories. But I'm now going to hand over to Luke for our fan favourite game, Conspiracy.
Well, hey, I love how it's always referred to as fan favourite game.
And host favourite.
Yeah, thanks for that, John. That's right. It's time for another game of our favourite Conspiracy. And for anyone that's new to the podcast, Conspiracy is a game. I have three conspiracies or mysteries, two of which I found somewhere on the internet and, someone either believes them and has wrote about them. And one of them I've completely made up, and it's my co-host's job to find out and work out which one I've made up. So without further ado, let's get into our conspiracies. The first one I've got for you is that Jesus is actually Julius Caesar.
Ooh.
The second one is that the Romans stole parts of Stonehenge, and that's why there's missing parts of Stonehenge.
Rate that. If they got the logistics to pull that off, pyramids are definitely built by humans.
Yeah.
And the last one for you is the most expensive feast of all time was held by Queen Boudica after successfully defeating the Romans for the third time.
Right, well, for an initial listen, I have no idea which one you've made up. So if you'd like to tell us a little bit more, that'll be very much appreciated.
Yeah, for sure. So starting with the idea that Jesus is actually Julius Caesar, obviously we know that the Romans and the Christians, as Callum mentioned in his own theory, were at war pretty much and hated each other and were also around at the same time. And it actually turns out that Jesus's life is actually very similar to the life of Caesar, to the extent that in the Gospel of St. Thomas, it actually states that Jesus was showed a gold coin, of which the people said to him, "Caesar's men, this man taxes from us." And Jesus actually replied to say, "Give me what is mine," and took the gold coin. So putting two and two together, he's collecting the taxes and he's actually Julius Caesar. But just going a bit more on from that, people in the stories of Caesar and people in the stories of Jesus are pretty much the same people by name and location. So you see a lot of people popping up in the same stories and the same locations. However, this idea was completely wiped out by the Romans after Caesar died and Jesus died. And obviously we know that Caesar was killed by the Romans and Jesus was also killed by the Romans. So there you go.
Did Caesar also turn two bread and five fishes into feeding the 5,000?
He actually turned it into a Caesar salad, but
never bottomless Caesar salad.
Not quite the same, but yeah, you never know. In terms of Stonehenge, I don't know if you guys know, there's actual parts of Stonehenge that are missing and we have no idea where they've gone. But we know that Stonehenge is the center of the Druids, or is relatively commonly believed to be the center of the Druids. And the Romans absolutely hated the Druids. When the Romans invaded Britain, they feared the Scots and they feared the Druids. And they managed to basically wipe out all the Druids that were, in Wales, Anglesey and that area. Because they believed the Druids had magical healing powers and they were scared of them, They believed that Stonehenge also had magical healing powers. So they kind of took parts of the stones and took them back to Rome and also sold them because they claimed they had magical healing powers.
Well, it seems to have done half the job at best. There you go, you got bored halfway through and realized they didn't actually have healing powers. Just realized they're selling worthless rock.
For all we know, they might have sold one to the Egyptians and it's sitting atop of the pyramid right now.
That would be something.
And then, so I mentioned Boudica. I don't really know how well-known Boudica is around the world. Obviously, she's very famous in British, but just for listeners who might not know who she is, she led British revolts against the Romans. And she won, I think, 3 times before she was defeated by Nero or when Nero was in charge. So she held the most expensive feast of all time after a British revolt against the Romans for the 3rd time was successful. And she captured Crassus, was a Roman general in Britain, and she also captured other Roman hierarchy who had been trusted to overlook Britannia. The reason it's the most expensive feast of all time is she proceeded to dissolve all their expensive jewellery in vinegar before drinking the vinegar. And it's believed that Boudica drank £20 million worth of vinegar in today's money.
Christ.
Jesus. And no wonder they thought we were primitive. I'm just burning down a fortune.
Get it down your neck, lad.
They're doing golden shit.
Yeah, I mean, that must have not gone down her esophagus well. I mean, a drink of vinegar on its own bad enough, let alone with a load of dissolved jewellery in it. But
heavy metals and all sorts in there. But I suppose we were a hardy bunch back then. I suppose our intestines could take it. Makes me Alexander the Great look like a bit of a wuss now, dying after drinking only 20 pints of wine or whatever it was. Whereas us Brits are over here drinking molten gold.
But yeah, that rounds up my 3 conspiracies for you. So you guys got any clues on which one I've made up?
I don't really want to do much of a disservice, but even after those extra informations, those tidbits, I have no idea whatsoever.
And that is what I love to hear.
I agree. I normally have a bit of an inkling, but I don't really. I know which one I'm going to go for, but there isn't really any reasoning behind it. As I said, I'm just going to go.
But do you want to take a stab in the dark now to foreshadow what happened to Julius Caesar?
Yeah, go on then. So I'm going to say that the conspiracy, the one you've made up, is the Stonehenge one.
No reasoning whatsoever, just okay, I like the sound of it.
I suppose when he read the other two out, I just felt there was enough detail that I thought I'd be impressed if he's made it up. So I've gone with the Stonehenge one.
Fair enough.
But yeah, it's not based on a great deal.
I'll have to go. My reasoning is sort of similar. I basically, this was a Freudian slip earlier when I said stab in the dark like Julius Caesar. I'm going to say that Jesus being Julius Caesar is the conspiracy just because I'm not really basing it off anything. It's just sort of gut feeling, I guess.
So you're opting for Caesar, Jesus, and Callum, and you're opting for Stonehenge, John.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. Final answer, lock it in.
Yeah. Well, going from start to finish, I can confirm that it is actually a conspiracy out there that people believe Jesus is actually Julius Caesar. You know, it's the reasons I gave. I mean, they're very tenuous and clutching at straws, but someone's put that, so I'm claiming it.
Fair enough.
So, yeah, in terms of Stonehenge, we do not have any records of the Romans knowing Stonehenge actually existed at all. We obviously know the Romans hate Druids, and it's very strongly theorized that the Druids built Stonehenge, but there's actually no records of Stonehenge, of the Romans knowing about Stonehenge. So for that reason, you might believe it's a loss for conspiracy, but it is actually a big win for conspiracy because parts of Stonehenge are missing, and it was theorized in the 16th century that the Romans were behind Stonehenge disappearing
because of magical
healing powers. And in terms of the Boudica story, John was saying he doesn't believe I'm creative enough to make that up. And he would be right. I was not creative enough to make it up. I stole it from another story, relates to the Romans. So Cleopatra once bet Mark Antony that she could blow $20 million in today's money on 1 meal. She then requested vinegar and put her earring in a vinegar and drank it.
Wow. I would say hats off to you. That was a very creative episode, even if you didn't nick it from the Egyptians.
Well, Mark Antony's a Roman, and yeah, it has got a Roman link there. Cleopatra and Mark Antony coming in big.
Yeah, I suppose history, like life imitating art, history stealing from other history, got it all. Like John was saying, oh yeah, I'm in the driving seat here now, when he was recounting that the Romans had no recollection of Stonehenge. But
if John knew me well enough, he'd know I'm a big Boudicca fan, and therefore I would have made a conspiracy about Boudicca. But yeah, that rounds up. It's a rare double win for conspiracy today. And thank you to everybody for listening. And it's goodbye from me. And keep challenging the status quo.
Adios. Bye.